that contemporary with Earl Dodge. And I'm sure Derek was also born in 1874. And this name, age, you know, remembering birthdays of both. I've outlived Sternberg by 3 years. Sternberg is a challenge to music historians and to students in music history, because he is remembered not so much for compositions, per se, specific repertory. He is remembered for his new approach to harmony and to harmonic organization. When you stop to think about it, Sternberg is probably one of the few composers that we approach absolutely backwards to our introduction to other composers of Western art music, other musical traditions of the West. In other words, to whatever extent you heard art music before you came to WBU, to whatever extent you heard jazz, rock, country, whatever, your first encounters with it, with all of these musics, was entirely oral, followed by some performance. You come to the university, you come to begin an undergraduate study in music, and then you learn the principles of harmony that underlie these musics. With Schoenberg, I'm willing to bet you, if your experience is anything like mine, you start with the harmony, and oh, by the way, he did like the music. See what I mean? As a consequence of this reverse pedagogy, people's opinions of Schoenberg are based upon their understanding of and affinity for his harmonic language, not upon the sounds he created. I sincerely doubt that any of you said, well, I used to like Beethoven until I had to analyze his music. Or, I used to like Wagner or Debussy until I had to try to sort out what the hell was going on two-thirds of the way through the Prelude to Tristan and Isolde. And now I can't stand either one of them. No. In that regard, I would argue that Schoenberg gets a very long breath. And I acknowledge that the pedagogy by which he is approached is the cause of this. It's not you or any others who come to understand his music as the product of rational approach to harmony. So what I want to do today is, in a sense, humanize Schoenberg by making clear what his agenda was, what led him to develop this agenda that resulted in the formation of a organization of chromatic harmony known as serialism or 12-tone or dodecaphony. These are three synonymous terms. And also, at the same time, as humanizing him, in a sense, rein in his pretensions. Because part of the rhetoric surrounding Schoenberg by his advocates is that harmony in Western music had come to an end and Schoenberg saved it. Well, that's obviously untrue. Duke Ellington never felt there was a crisis in Western harmony when he started composing in the 1920s. Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copland hardly reflects some crisis with tonal harmony. The blues hardly was threatened by decline of harmony. No. One man's vision, Schoenberg, about a very particular aspect of Western harmonic language in a very particular place, Vienna, At a very particular time, the teens of the 20th century, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about the whole of Western art music. We're not certainly talking about the whole of Western music. Claims made on Schoenberg's behalf by his disciples are gross exaggerations. But let's begin by understanding Schoenberg's basic worldview. And to do so, I would argue strenuously that this approach to harmonic organization was prompted by essentially a conservative philosophy about music of Europe. Now, when we use the term radical, which is thrown about as if people knew what the word actually meant, you know, Muqtada al-Sadr is not a Muslim cleric. He is a radical Muslim cleric. Listen to the radical Muslim cleric. The hair stands up on the back of your neck when you hear radical Muslim cleric. What does the word radical mean? What it means, what it really means, is of or pertaining to the root of something. Because it comes from the Greek word radix, which means root. If somebody is being radical, they are going to the root of a phenomenon, its origins. And they are re-examining it in terms of where it started and where it is wound up. Of course, today the term radical is associated with extremist. Utterly incorrect. And henceforth, I know you will all limit your use of the term radical to its proper formal definition. What was the impulse, the conservative impulse animating Schoenberg? He was this. He believed he was the heir to a great musical tradition. The tradition of art music as cultivated in Vienna. Vienna, not Austria, not Central Europe, not the Western world, Vienna, the capital of, when he was growing up, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the home of, without doubt, some of the greatest minds of Western art music. It was home, adopted home, to Beethoven. The adopted home of Brahms, the destination of Gustav Mahler. It had been home to Franz Josef Haydn and to Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Before then, to Johann Joseph Fuchs. We know him today as the author of the first textbook on counterpoint, a textbook that has only been transformed but never replace in terms of its fundamental rules of counterpoint. Fuchs, the Kapellmeister of the Cathedral of St. Stephen, Cathedral of Vienna. Schoenberg saw that great Viennese tradition in crisis because the harmonic order that underlay it, as indeed it underlay Western art music in general, European art music more particularly, Central European art music even more particularly, Viennese art music most especially. That harmonic order was being overwhelmed by chromaticism. The gradually and increasingly chromatic language of the late 19th century in Central Europe was compromising, undermining the order that pertained to diatonic harmony. The way he put it in an essay in 1941 was as follows. The ear had gradually become acquainted with a great number of dissonances, and so had lost the fear of their sense-interrupting effect. This is obviously American English translated from German. Since interrupting, meaning that they would cause us to lose sight of the tonic upon which harmonic language is grounded, sense of direction to the tonic. One no longer expected preparations of Wagner's dissonances or resolution of Strauss's dissonances. One was no longer disturbed by Debussy's non-functional harmonies or by the harsh counterpoint of later composers. But you've admitted to being somewhat disturbed by Debussy's non-functional harmonies if you have to analyze backwards. It's a sense of, it's not clear. This state of affairs led to a freer use of dissonances comparable to classic composers' treatment of diminished seventh chords, which could proceed and follow any other harmony, consonant or dissonance, as if there was no dissonance at all. How many of you have been mastering the implications of diminished seventh chords in theory? Does Mr. Swain, the rest of you, given up and couldn't even master them? How many of you have studied any seventh chord? No.
Yes.
And you know, because of their structure, a harmonic direction goes to a diminished seventh chord can go immediately in any one of a number of harmonic directions, at least four, if not more, by virtue of which of the elements of that chord you decide is going to be a leading tone preparing you to a dominant in a different key. Am I right? Yes. But when you have in the 18th century this, and in the 19th century the various augmented sixth chords, in Neapolitans, which you've also mastered, you are seeing the loosening up of the hierarchy of tonal harmony. No longer is it clear when you depart from a particular tonic where you will end up or how you will get there. Schoenberg's career was dedicated to coping with the crisis of Western harmony that he saw this free use of dissonance causing. Schoenberg was conservative because he believed in order. He believed in a harmonic language that was rational, that was ordered, not chaotic. And in his career, he proceeds, in effect, through two stages, the second stage of which has two parts. The first stage is his own wrestling with and composition in the diatonic chromaticism of Wagner, Mahler, and Brahms. Mahler and Brahms being residents of Vienna. Compositional practice continues to about 1907. Or so you say, until he is about 33 or 34 years old. He throws up his hands at that point. And says diatonic harmony is no longer functional. You can be arbitrary and declare a tonic at any point you want to, but there's no driving force behind it. So he says, well, let's be honest. Let's abandon this in favor of what would come to be called atonality. He referred to it as pan-tonality, but that term never stuck. Atonality means there is no tonic. All 12 pitches of the chromatic scale have equal weight. But there was a problem. A problem that it took him about 16 years, interrupted, of course, by World War I, to fully acknowledge and then to find a solution. Atonality had no alternate harmonic organization. Around 1922-1923, he, along with his student Anton Weber, developed an alternative theory that organizes the 12 by which Turner is known. As you read about these developments, which I will flesh out now under Roman numeral 2, I strongly encourage your close critical reading of the essay in the Gold Book that begins on page 73 concerning Schoenberg's progression of thinking about harmonic language. And then proceed to read Mark Evans Bynes, chapter 21. It's titled Beyond Tonality. Read closely, read carefully. So, let us proceed to consider the two stages of Schoenberg's career, this being the first, these two representing the second, and at that second stage, we have phase one and phase two. To begin with, I want to consider an early example of Schoenberg's post-romantic, post-Wagnerian style. A composition for string sextet that dates from the year 1899, called Verklärte Nacht, auf Englisch, Transfigured Night. String sextets were not invented by Schoenberg. Indeed, if he was looking for immediate models for his string quartet, a string sextet, you know, further to look than Johannes Brahms, who had died only a couple of years before this work was written. This is focus. Let's see if we can make it work. Yes. Now let's see if we can make that. You can make it work. Sorry. There we go. Now let's zoom in and throw all that off. Still in focus-ish. As you look at this work, you should see right away that it is grounded in atonic pitch. It has a key sequence, suggesting of D minor, as indeed the cello pedal point makes it clear. This is, incidentally, a symphonic poem. It is based upon a poem by Richard Demed. It tells the story of a woman who has been unfaithful to her lover, has become pregnant, confesses to her lover that she is pregnant, and when he says, he forgives this momentary lapse, and will indeed be father to the child, having told him this at night up in the big garden, the night is transformed. All is well. As we listen to this, I think you will be struck by its very unabrasive harmonic language. It's very chromatic, but nevertheless, totally grounded. his conclusion that the traditional harmonic order had essentially vanished led to its composition of a number of works, as you know. In a harmonic language, we customarily refer to as atonality. This kind of compositional activity began in 1907. In terms of the music that he composed in this period, it is worth noting that at the same time, in other related artistic media, we discover that his atonal music is part and parcel of a movement known as Expressionism. Expressionism not only manifests itself in musical compositions, largely through vocal compositions, art songs, it also is to be found expressed in the visual arts, including paintings by Schoenberg, who for a while toyed with the idea of abandoning music in favor of art, and in the theater. The best definition, short definition of expressionism that I recently heard was about this. Expressionism refers to art, and I'm speaking of art in the broadest of senses, that takes an inner psychological reality, and projects it upward. In other words, it takes the inner emotional conflicts that people experience and brings them out for the audience to contemplate. These inner realities that were projected outward include those associated with mental instability, arising from various forms of emotional repression that characterize the equally repressed social environment of the first two decades, a decade and a half of the 20th century. A time when people were not supposed to express publicly, overtly, outwardly, any emotional state other than happiness. Such repression, of course, has extraordinary and adverse consequences. Composers, playwrights, and artists confronted, contested with this notion of repression in works of art in various media that expose the consequences of such emotional repression. Among the more famous, and probably because of its fame, misunderstood by many, is a painting by the Norwegian expressionist Edvard Munch. It is reproduced on page 579 of your textbook. It is called Speak, in Norwegian, the Scream, in English. 579. On that page, in the caption, you will read that Munch was inspired by a poem written in sometime after 1883. By another Norwegian named Arthur von Trakett, which could be said to describe a panic attack. The poem in translation reads, I was walking with two friends, the sun was sinking, the sky was red as blood, a sense of melancholy came over me. I stopped, sick and tired unto death. Above the dark fjord in the city there was blood and tongue-like flames. My friends continued onward, but I stayed behind, trembling and anxious. It was as if a scream were tearing through nature. And in this particular painting, which has been parodied to the point where people, I think, must work hard to reconstruct their engagement with the original, we have that blood-red sky, we have the two friends, and we have the man who is silently crying out whose hands are on either side of his head, almost as if to keep his sanity together through physical intervention. The blood-red sky of the times may have struck some people upon reading the poem or seeing this as more of the exaggerated effect to depict emotional instability. But in truth, art historians have reflected on the fact that when Munch painted this in 1893, he was just a few years after the extraordinary volcanic eruption in the southwestern Pacific, the island of Krakatoa, which had basically blown up in an extraordinary volcanic explosion, not simply eruption, explosion, that filled the sky with volcanic particles of ash that circled the planet five times at least in the course of the normal migration of the winds, which had indeed turned sunsets brilliantly red throughout the world. Thus, we have a connection between the natural phenomenon and emotional disintegration represented in this painting. Schoenberg's contribution to this examination, this expressionist examination of mental instability, was, of course, his setting of 21 poems in the cycle known as Piero Lunaire. And indeed, in the period of atonal music, it was the very presence of a text which helped keep the compositions together. You had no sense of harmonic direction in atonality. You had no sense of drive to atonic. So the text and its exposition was used to create the form. You've already examined the Acclamant in CPQ number 4, the 7th of the 21 poems, 7 of the 21 art songs, the one that ends the first of the three sections of Piero Lunaire. And therefore you know that this notion that expressionism is an outward projection of inter-emotional conditions, that outwardness was in part reflected in the style of the singing, the speech song, the Sprechstimme, in which the singer is not on pitch for any period of time, indeed in various ways swoops from one pitch to another, as if to suggest by that imprecision, seeming imprecision of intonation, the instability. You know, you can't sing on pitch if you're going nuts, would be sort of the subtext of that. So why should somebody stand there and say, I am having a catastrophic mental breakdown? That's not how you convey such. So those who would react negatively to this admittedly uncharacteristic vocal style need to be brought up short by realizing, well, how are you going to do that? How are you going to convey to an audience this inner emotional turmoil? You can only do it in a way that in effect confronts the audience with the consequences of that, so that the audience itself has a vicarious experience of the mental illness, the derangement, the loss of control of emotions. Now, having heard that, let's consider the 14th song, the one that ends the second section, called Die Kreuze, the crosses. Again, we have the same kind of vocal delivery, because the character of Pierrot, the moonstruck clown, is no better off than number 14. Than he was in number 7. poems for the affect. Poems are poets' holy crosses on which they bleed in silence, struck blind by family swarms of fluttering vultures. Swords have feasted on their bodies, reveling in the scarlet blood. Poems are poets' holy crosses on which they bleed in silence. Dead by head, the tresses stiffen far away the noisy rabble. Slowly the sun sinks, a royal red crown. Poems are poets' holy crosses. Language that sounds like free association. Language that conveys all sorts of extraordinary images. Distorted images. The effects of the insanity, the lunacy of the terror. A musical setting which projects the effect of those images is what characterizes not only the setting, but the vocal style. It's all of a piece, it is all tightly unified. Needless to say, Pierrot Lunaire is not the sort of repertory that gets performed with any frequency. People are quite uncomfortable having to engage with such overt manifestations of derangement. It's not the thing that gets my stop and look at Alice Tully Hall before, unless we have a particular expectation for engaging with a historic musical document. The lingering, the enduring importance of Pierrot Lunaire, interestingly enough, is in the instrumentation. Because Schoenberg quite unwittingly established a chamber music ensemble that has endured to the present day. In fact, it is known as a Pierrot ensemble. It consists of a piano, a cello, a violin, a clarinet, and a flute. In Pierrot Lunaire, the clarinetist doubles on bass clarinet, the flute on piccolo, the violin on viola. An example of the use of the Pierrot ensemble is to be found in the composition by George Cromer. 11 Echoes of Autumn, 1965. I remind you again, 1965 is part of the title, which is for piano, violin, flute, and or now, I said that Schoenberg disliked chaos, needed order. Atonality did not provide him with order. He and Baird and Webern, his principal students, wrote art songs. They wrote short character pieces based on motives they developed. But there was no means by which to compose an extended orchestral or instrumental composition. Thus it was that a sense of order and logic had to be imposed, and surrealism provided that order. Let me say, incidentally, that the preeminent expressionist opera was Alban Baird's Buchsack, about a private in the Austrian army of limited intelligence and emotional stability. Interestingly enough, it is based upon a set of scenes that were written at the beginning of the 19th century, essentially forgotten about and only resurrected in the early 20th. The story of Buchsack is a story of a man who has limited emotional stability, as I said, and intelligence, who is driven insanely jealous by the unfaithfulness of his girlfriend. And in the sort of ending that you read about on Monday mornings in the Dominion Post, as they happened on Saturday night after the Sunday papers went press, he kills his girlfriend and drowns himself. Today you don't do it that way, of course. You shoot the girlfriend and then shoot yourself. and the most poignant of closing scenes of any opera of which I am aware. His girlfriend and his child. Unaware of his mother has been killed, and his father has committed suicide. He's outside when a group of children come up and say, there's a body over there, let's go see. And he is playing by himself, singing to himself, hip hop, hip hop, hip hop. And then he runs off straight. Twelve-tone composition, serialist, dodecaphony, was intended by its creators to establish order over a chromatic harmony, over a chromatic scale. And in so doing, effectively replaced the old hierarchy with a new one. What do I mean by the old hierarchy? Well, here's the way to think about it, as has been suggested by more than one scholar. Diatonic harmony is a reflection of, is a projection of the absolute monarchies of Europe. At the top, you have the emperor or the king. That's the tonic. The tonic is served by a prime minister. That's the dominant, right below. The court, who presumably answers to the commands of the king and certainly to the commands of the prime minister, are 2, 4, and 6. Those who are basically outside the loop but occasionally reference the rest of the empire, the rest of the kingdom, are 3. Sometimes there's a rival to the prime minister that is clearly subserving, that's 7. Everybody below the time serves the time by leading us back to the time, either directly, as in 5 and 7, or to prepare for the intervention of 5 and 7, 2, 4, and 6. Make any sense? That makes sense. It's a metaphor for absolute monarchy. Materialism is the antithesis. There is order. But it's an order that includes everybody on an equal level. It is an ordering of all 12 pitches of the chromatic scale, not in a hierarchy, but in a row. A row that originates as a melody. A row that includes all pitches, and indeed ensures that no one pitch is more important than any other. Because in the exposition of that row, you don't repeat the pitch. You bring the row from all together. Everybody has a voice. And every composition has a new row, a new arrangement. There's no single row for all music. There's no single row for all compositions. Every composition is vulnerable. Schoenberg's first complete composition to make use of this new logic, this new order, was his Opus 25, his Suite für Klavier. We haven't heard about suites in my head in a long time since the term suite has been part of our list of genres. Reminds us that Schoenberg was in his own way part of the neoclassical movement, of which I'll have more to say on Monday. The composition was based upon this ordering of the 12 pitches of the chromatic scale. Schoenberg said that one should begin a composition by a melody. A melody that consists of the 12 pitches of the chromatic scale. Copland echoed that, if I'm not mistaken. Even though connotations begin to chords. others want to develop Ojibwe. Others want to develop harmonically in the 12-tone domain. But you don't have fives and threes and ones. But you have something analogous in terms of modulation. You introduce, as he did, inverted transpose forms of that prime note. One of six semitones. Notice it's a tritone. Consider this. Mr. Carr, tell us. What is the next interval above a tritone? Exactly. Tonic dominant relationship. Yes. The tritone relationship is as close as you can get to the old order of 1-5 without seeing it. Make sense? Is that clear to everyone? Inverted. To be inverted is to go down instead of up. If we imagine that E fall rises to F by a semitone, B flat falls by a semitone to A. If F and G, we go up a major second, from F to G, we go down a major second, from A to G. How many of you have had some introduction to serial harmony in your class? So I'm telling you only what you know, and I'm contextualizing the story. He also transposed the prime form of six semitones. That same tritone relationship. That same almost a fifth, but not quite. And he presents the inverted form starting with the same initial pitch as the prime. E, E. E up a semitone, E down a semitone. E up a major second, E down. And so, very rigorous and very close to the original. He writes a suite. A suite is a collection of dances. Begins with a prelude. Box suites often begin with a prelude. Keyboard suites. Cello suites. Partitas, another name for suite. And the way he presents these, we have kind of an antecedent consequent relationship. Boy, that is so 18th century. Antecedent consequent relationship. D0 to the inverted of the tritone. D6 to the inverted of the original. Order and logic preoccupied. Let's consider this, just for larks. Let's imagine taking Schoenberg's vocabulary of woes, find, transpose, verbs, and let's say they apply this to a composition by Mozart, just to show comparisons. So now in B flat major. Well, the first form of the row, prime. Right? The B flat major scale. D7, not D6, D7. Seven semitones is the perfect fifth. Here we have a F major scale. Subdominant, of course, E5, E flat major scale. My point in doing this is to say let's be more conscious of continuity and the continuation of tradition than all this gee whiz Schoenberg writes 12-tone harmony. As if there's no historic continuity, as if there's no logic connecting this. As if Schoenberg is, as I've almost heard him described at times, because of his challenge to the old order of harmony, the antichrist of Western art. He isn't. He is continuing a tradition that he believes is in jeopardy. Did everybody find the literature was in jeopardy? No! He did. His students did. Their students were persuaded of the virtues of serial harmony. But it is part and parcel of a tradition. In fact, here's an interesting question to think about for some upcoming occasion. discuss the ways in which Arnold Schoenberg's serial harmony is a continuation of harmonic thought originating in the 18th century. The ways in which it is a continuation. Let's not worry about how it's different. How is it a continuation? What does he do? Well, he maintains forms, genres, associations between various forms of the role that have their analogs therein. Here's part of a fugue subject. This is the prime form of that fugue. It's the subject. And the fourth, using the same basic subject, it presents a new version. You know, ba da 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 da. Okay. Any questions? Do you want me to touch on again? Yes, sir, Mr. Kolak.
It's called the name.
Schoenberg, yes.
Yes.
Now, why have you done that? I will tell you. Why have you seen it both ways? Because you're a servant. That's one reason. The other reason is this. In Germany, in German, we have this thing called Schoenna. So the result is churn there. American English doesn't mess with diacritical markings. So the approximation of the O umlaut is OE. You choose to be Austrian or American. You can say. Okay? Robert Mays, my mentor, whose name, as you observe, is MOE. Yes, and whose Dutch ancestry would have suggested it should have been Emil Umlaut at some point, Ms. did identify him as not in presence. For some bizarre reason, we refer to him as Schoenberg, which is sort of a corrupt Yiddish pronunciation of Schoen, as in by Neil Bisku Schoen, a popular song in the 1920s and 30s. Anyway, that's the reason. Have a nice weekend.